Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi everyone, it's 4 o'clock in New York. New signs that the big lie of a stolen 2020 election and the radicalization of one of our country's two major political parties has turned into a five-alarm fire for American democracy, and new evidence that it will fall on Democrats and like-minded Americans to try to put out that fire in the coming months. Extraordinary new reporting in the New York Times lays out in graphic detail the extent to which the Stop the Steal movement holds power in state houses all across our country now. From that Times reporting, at least 357 sitting Republican legislators in closely contested battleground states have used the power of their office to try to discredit or try to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. The Times analysis exposes how deeply rooted lies and misinformation about ex-President Donald Trump's defeat have become in state legislatures, which play an integral role in U.S. democracy. In sum, the false view that the election was stolen, either by fraud or as a result of pandemic-related changes to the process, is now widely accepted as fact among Republican lawmakers, turning state houses into hotbeds of conspiratorial thinking and specious legal theories. According to the Times report, 44% of Republican legislators in nine key swing states took steps to overturn the 2020 election. It's a staggering number. And now ahead of the next presidential election, the disgraced ex-president and his allies are trying to add to those ranks more Republicans who are all too willing to overturn the will of the voters in their states. There's a startling and significant admission from the ex-president himself. Quote, in an interview with the Times, Trump acknowledged that in deciding whom to endorse in state legislative races, he's looking for candidates who want state legislatures to have a say in naming presidential electors, a position that could let politicians short-circuit the democratic process and override the popular vote. And it's not just state houses. Big lie candidates are hoping to become governors, secretaries of state, U.S. senators, and congressmen and women. And thanks in part to Donald Trump's endorsements, many of them, not all of them, many of them are winning their primaries. Look at Pennsylvania, where January 6th rally organizer Doug Mastriano is the Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania. The wave of big lie Republican candidates winning their party's nominations means that Democrats have become the last line of defense, and that it's on Democrats now, for better or for worse, to convince the rest of America that democracy is what's at stake. Here's Doug Mastriano's opponent, Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Democratic nominee for governor, Josh Shapiro.
My opponent, Senator Mastriano, he wants to take us to a divisive and dark place where he has openly talked, if he were governor, about with the stroke of a pen, being able to do away with voting machines that had votes on it that he didn't agree with. And it's very dangerous because here in Pennsylvania, the next governor will appoint the Secretary of State, and the governor alone appoints electors based on the will of the people. And Senator Mastriano has made it clear that he will appoint the electors based on his belief system. Listen, he's essentially saying, sure, you can go vote, but I'll pick the winner. That's incredibly dangerous. And it is what is at stake in this governor's race.
The big lie is a clear and present danger to our democracy, and how to fight back against it is where we start the hour. Nick Korsunides here, New York Times domestic correspondent. His byline is on that reporting we read from extensively at the top. With us at the table, let me say that again, at the table, Michelle Sinder, NBC News Washington correspondent, moderator of Washington Week on PBS. Also, former senator and MSNBC political analyst Claire McCaskill's here, and former top State Department official and MSNBC contributor, usually helming the table shift by himself, Rick Stengel's back. Nick, take me through this reporting. It's another incredible piece of reporting, greatly enhanced by some graphics. I'm going to put some of them up. This is the percentage of Republican legislators in each state who took steps to overturn or discredit the 2020 election. In Arizona, 81% of that state's legislators tried to overturn the will of the vote there, certified by a Republican governor. In Wisconsin, 73%. In Georgia, 23%. In Pennsylvania, 78%. Michigan, 48%. And Nevada at 4%. Take us through what you and your colleagues are reporting.
Well, what we wanted to do with this story was look at concrete action. So not get into the rhetoric, not get into, you know, what people might be saying on social media for political gain, but what did they actually do to try and either overturn the 2020 election or kind of take steps to either discredit or mess with further and future elections? So we focused on either letters to Congress, you know, joining this legally dubious or implausible movement called decertification. And we also looked at audits. Or so-called audits, I should say. They're not actually official audits, in part because we saw in numerous states that audits weren't just a political messaging movement to try and appeal to the base or former President Trump, but they were actually the first step in what was often more concrete actions to either discredit, overturn the 2020 election, or, you know, create a constitutional crisis. We looked at, for example, the so-called audit in Arizona. And in some of the findings that were published that were also debunked by local Republican election officials were taken verbatim from the report from that audit and put into a resolution by Mark Finchem, who is a Republican member of the legislature in Arizona, also a candidate for Secretary of State right now. And he took those verbatim as justification to try and promote this idea of decertification, which is, again, not a plausible theory, but is one more piece of concrete action that state legislatures are taking to try and mess still with the 2020 election. So tracing that from the audit to decertification to then a statement that Mr. Finchem put about the justification for decertification, which is this independent state legislature theory, which is stating that legislatures have complete control over elections and therefore could appoint electors or change laws or things like that. So we wanted to use these concrete actions, including these partisan election reviews and so-called audits, to kind of illustrate exactly what happened and just how deep some of these conspiracies and falsehoods about the 2020 election remain in these state houses.
Well, Nick, it's an incredible piece of reporting. And I just want to sort of highlight and have you help me do this if I leave anything out, the behaviors, the actions, as you're saying, that you tracked graphically in this reporting. There's decertification. There's the auditing. There's also the alternate slates of electors, which you go through and report out in a data-driven way. Most of what we know about that is because it's believed to be under scrutiny by both the Justice Department and the January 6th committee. Talk about how rampant the production of alternate fraudulent slates of electors was.
Well, that even gets back to kind of what I was just talking about with this independent state legislature doctrine. And that's this legal theory that state legislatures have this absolute control over elections and can indeed send alternate slates of electors. Now, there was varying degrees of support for this in different legislatures. In Michigan, for example, you saw numerous sitting state legislatures trying to help these alternate slates of electors to get into the Capitol building. Back when the election was being certified, some in other states were even electors themselves. In Arizona, Mr. Hoffman was. And then in other states, you actually saw a resistance from some Republicans to these alternate slates of electors. The Nevada Republican Party was pushing this. They held a press conference with all of the alternate electors, you know, standing before a camera. So they weren't necessarily hiding from anything. Saying this is what we want to do. We believe that the election was compromised and we need to put forth these electors for Congress to consider. And there wasn't any appetite within the Nevada Republican caucus in either state, in either chamber in the state legislature to go along with that. So it kind of depended on the state as to how warmly they embraced this theory of alternate slates of electors. But almost every legal expert I spoke to said putting forward any kind of alternate slates of electors likely would have been illegal, yet still probably would have caused some kind of constitutional crisis that would have really, you know, unmoored us even further in that tumultuous time after the 2020 election.
And Nick, just one more question about the reporting. I mean, I think we first started calling on you almost every day when you were doing reporting out the voter suppression laws in Georgia and the attempts. I think there are 48 states contemplating voter suppression. They call them voter integrity laws predicated on the big lie. This almost seems like the bookend of that body of reporting, that the lie fueled efforts to make it harder for communities of color to vote. But the lie also seems to have rushed into office in a structural capacity, the kinds of people who will do whatever Donald Trump wants him to do anyway.
Yeah, and we saw, you know, in a lot of those laws that we spoke about last year, and there's also 18 more laws that have been passed this year that include some restrictions to voting. You know, in the preambles of a lot of that, it talks about this crisis of confidence in elections. And I think what our reporting shows, based on a lot of the actions that some of these state legislatures took, that they contributed to that erosion of trust in elections by perpetuating these falsehoods and trying to prolong, you know, either the debate or even overturn the 2020 election. And I don't think, you know, it's necessarily over. At the end of our story, we look at how former President Trump is trying to mold certain state legislatures to fit this idea and to have more closely aligned allies in state legislatures, possibly for the next election. In Michigan specifically, you know, he's endorsed 10 candidates for state legislatures, some who are even challenging current Republican incumbents. His committee, Save America, has maxed out to 9 of those candidates. And what he asked those candidates is, you know, one of the criteria that he's weighing when either him or staff talk to them is, you know, what's your thought on electors and how do you think state legislature should play in these elections? And he told me that that's a, you know, a very important thing. And when I was talking to one of those candidates, John Lindsay, a state Senate candidate in Michigan, he said, was it me in that seat? I would have voted to send Trump electors to Washington on January 6th.
Yamiche, I badly want to scream that this is bat bleep crazy, but it's time to get quiet. It's time to get mad. And it's time to address what Jim Clyburn, I think, calls out in a quote this weekend in The Washington Post. He says, we refuse to admit that we have a race problem in this country. The country is in danger of imploding. Democracy is in danger of disintegrating. And I don't know why people feel that this country is insulated from the historical trends. These trends are just clear to me. This is clear to me from the day Donald Trump was sworn into office. His speech, if you can call it that, at the inauguration was very clear to me. But we chose to ignore it, like we're ignoring stuff now. This stuff is dangerous, but maybe autocracy is the future of the country. I have had the pleasure of interviewing him. I have never heard him sound this concerned and this unclear about which path we'll take at this fork in the road.
And the weight of Joan Clyburn's words to me are in the fact that he is someone who has fought for civil rights, who went to jail in the 1960s, fighting and understanding that he still had to be optimistic about American democracy and the experiment as he was being beaten because he was a black man asking to be equal in this country. So if you take that context, you start off the show talking about a five alarm. This is Jim Clyburn doing that for us. This is Jim Clyburn saying America is not at all immune. We can absolutely go the way of Venezuela, the way of Haiti, the way of all these other countries that have seen their democracies fall apart. And as someone who's talked to a lot of immigrants who came to America because we sell this idea that our democracy is sort of foolproof and it's protected, those same immigrants were the same ones who were telling me before January 6th, there's going to be violence. And then after January 6th, they said, this isn't over. This is the beginning. So the bookend of this will be possibly dictatorship. It will be possibly the democracy falling apart if you have people in office that are saying you can vote all you want, but we know who's going to be the winner at the end of this. That's very scary. And when you look at these numbers by the New York Times, this incredible reporting by Nick and my former colleagues, it really in some ways is the kind of oral history and the kind of written history that we're going to need if things continue to get worse. The only thing that I can say out of this article that I read that kind of made me think, okay, well, maybe I'm not as sort of, maybe I don't want to go all the way to the dark place, is that they said, and the reporting says that these lawmakers, they haven't had the numbers to overturn the elections yet. They're not there yet. And of course, there's Brian Kemp and the Republican Governors Association in Georgia who are saying, Donald Trump, you can put millions of dollars into trying to get to unseat Brian Kemp, or we're going to do the same thing. We're going to put millions of dollars behind fighting that lie and fighting the idea that you have to say that the 2020 election was not fair in order to win in a Republican primary and to win a Republican seat. I think that to me is the only sort of bright side of this, that there are Republicans, at least in Georgia, who are the model for how you push back against the lie.
Okay, but I I thank you for your ray of optimism. I'm going to ruin it, though, because Brian Kemp's role in voter suppression in the state of Georgia was so reprehensible that baseball moved its all-star. No one else really did much, but baseball, who we never talk about baseball in the context of politics, thought that voter suppression law was so offensive, they moved the all-star game.
Well, that's the problem, right? The problem is that it was, as I tried to, like, struggle for that ray of light, and thank you for diminishing it and reminding me that we are a country with a race problem, is that these are all interconnected.
Right.
People who there are some who will say, okay, the 2020 election was not rigged, but still these people in this district who maybe happen to be brown, maybe happen to be black people, we know how they're going to vote. So we're going to try as much as possible to dilute their power. They're thinking that that's separate and different from people who are attacking the sort of credibility of American democracy. But if you do one, you're doing the other. If you say right. that these people in this district, that we're not going to give them the same amount of equal representation, then you are, in fact, acting against American democracy. And that is, of course, what Jim Clyburn, politics aside, has dedicated his life to. That is what so many people in the streets from the 1960s all the way to now have been dedicating their lives to, that everyone should have equal access, including people who are, of course, black or white, but also if you're Republican or Democrat. And right now we're often focused on the Democrat and Republican side. But as you bring up smartly, the racial aspect of this is not going to go away.
And not to totally ruin your optimism, but the reason that communities of color in Georgia don't have the same access to the polls is a lie. It's BS. As you're reporting, and Nick's entire body of reporting on the voter suppression laws will prove. So they took away access to the polls on the back of a big lie in service of Donald Trump.
They took access absolutely because of a lie, but also I would say that there also is racism in there, and the racism is a lie,
right?
Exactly. It's like the lie and racism, which is a lie, which is that these black people don't deserve the access to citizenship in the way that other Americans do, that they haven't worked for it, that they don't understand sort of the weight of American democracy, and as a result, we need to make decisions for them. I think those two things are so intertwined in this country. We often, I think, get to talk about the political side of this, but the race side of this, and the fact that Jim Clyburn is saying, in a country where we saw George Floyd die, it's going to be 2 years this week that we saw this man murdered. In that same country, we're still sort of arguing about whether or not we want to teach our children and our students about whether or not sort of racism has continued to permeate all of these different structures, when we know graphically, we know statistically that that is simply a fact.
Well, and the lived experience of the Post reports on that 2-year anniversary is that 8 out of 10 Americans live in fear of violence. I mean, I think we separate them maybe at our own peril. It's all one piece, and it's all in service of Donald Trump. But it's they made a Frankenstein that has run out of the lab. Maybe I'm watching too many Marvel movies, but it's all one. They took the big lie. They passed voter suppression laws. There are 430 of them, making their way through 48 states. And they're stacking state legislatures. I'm sure it's happening in your state, Claire.
Well, there's one simple thing that we all need to think about. I am so used to Democratic activists across this country being very up to date. I was at the Profiles in Courage dinner last night.
Amazing.
So many people came up to me and they wanted to know about how Mark Kelly is doing in Arizona and how Maggie Hassan is doing in New Hampshire. These were very educated voters, that many of them were big donors to a lot of Senate candidates. And I wanted to say to all of them, how many of you have gotten to a state representative race? Mm. How many people out there that are wringing their hands and worried about the future of our country, how close attention are you paying to who represents you in state government? There are a lot of people that could help a little bit in some of these races in Michigan, where you've got an incumbent Republican being challenged by one of these jokers that Trump has recruited to say voters don't matter anymore. I just want people who are going to put me in office. You can beat those people. You can give resources. And is it against my grain to give resources to a Republican running in a state rep race? Well, normally it would be, but this isn't normal anymore.
Right.
It is time now that we start paying attention to state legislatures, paying attention to the extremism, the craziness. In fact, there were many award winners last night that were moving, and I got to mention two of them just briefly. One was Shea Moss, who was the woman who was targeted that worked for the Fulton County Election Board because she was doing what she was supposed to do, moving ballots out of a
secure area.
She
became a piece of right-wing disinformation.
She had to move her family. She was threatened. It was a nightmare for her. And she was amazing last night. She spent all of her speech talking about all the election workers around the country instead of about herself. Then it's Rusty Bowers. Rusty Bowers is the senator in Nevada that stopped the law. The Republican leader of the Senate in Arizona that stopped the law that would have given the power to the state legislature. Yeah. It was a Republican who stood up and said enough. You know, Liz Cheney was amazing, too. But we do need to recognize that there are some people in the Republican Party that are worried also. They know this has gone too far. How many of them deserve a profile in courage right now? Not enough. But I do think we got to pay attention to these state legislative races.
I don't disagree. I do think it's overwhelming to people to say I have to pay attention to my school board vote. I have to pay attention to the bond vote to make sure the school is funded. I have to pay attention to my governor's race. I have to vote in a midterm. I have to vote in a presidential. And I have to worry about some joker in a state legislature in Arizona, because the variable isn't that these offices suddenly matter. The variable is that the Republican Party has broken bad and been corrupted by tinfoil hat wearing anti-democratic figures.
Their question.
What do we do? What's the answer? What would you put on the cover of Time magazine? Would you be covering the end of democracy in America, as Jim Clyburn suggests? This stuff is dangerous, but maybe autocracy is the future of our country.
Yeah, no, the Jim Clyburn thing really depressed me, because he's an optimist and he's fought for democracy. He's shed blood for democracy. And I'm trying to kind of reconcile all of these strands. I mean, part of the problem is that we have this 18th century system that we're trying to make function in the 21st century. We still don't have direct electoral voting for the president of the United States. I mean, we may be the last country in the world. We were the first democracy, the first representative democracy, but we have this crazy thing called the Electoral College. And even as Nick was talking about, there is plenty of law that says the state legislatures do make decisions about electors. Well, I think that's crazy. I think it's 200 years old legal theory, but it's something that people can debate. And the problem is that these Republicans, these Trumpsters, who basically look at it from, well, the outcome isn't what I want, therefore, how do I change the outcome? They're using and manipulating this old, creaky system to get to the outcome that they want by using decertification or these or legal
decertification theories. Audits and alternate slates.
And to go back to the beginning of your question, I mean, democracy takes work. Everybody, it doesn't go of itself. Everybody has to participate. And to Claire's point, it's like, yes, we have to think about all those things. And I have to think about who's running for school board in my district and who's running for the state legislature. That's something a lot of people don't necessarily pay attention to. But that's what the Trumpsters are trying to exploit, your lack of attention and the fact that you have all these other things going on.
People have to be willing to lose for democracies to function. And you are now getting into a party where they are refusing to lose.
Well, there are two. There's Kinzinger and Cheney. That's it.
Yeah.
And Rusty Bowers and a few others. That's it.
But lose and then peacefully hand over power.
Critical.
Yes.
Critical second step there. Yes. Lose and peacefully hand over power. And I remember talking to people, frankly, again, in Haiti when Hillary Clinton lost. And they said, well, you know, if it was Haiti, there would be bloodshed and there would be a whole thing, because there would be such sort of there would be just such chaos of someone not wanting to hand power over. But that didn't happen. Barack Obama showed up, even though he was someone who had been literally targeted by Donald Trump. He showed up to the inauguration. Everyone showed up, did what they had to do. And it's this time that Jim Clyburn is saying, are we going to end up in autocracy? Because people don't want to do, frankly, what both sides, whether it's George Bush or whether you're Barack Obama, both sides have to do, which is, as you said, lose and peacefully hand over power.
What do you think this moment is yielding that we don't see? I mean, do you think Democrats are as alarmed by Jim Clyburn's comments as we are? I mean, the problem is between the lie and pushing the kinds of candidates that Nick reports into obscure state offices and not so obscure ones like Secretary of State and Governor, it's a direct line. Believe the lie, vote for a lie, vote for a fraudster. The story, pro-democracy story, is more complicated. It's like you're saying, find the good eggs in both parties that are for democracy. What does the process look like behind the scenes?
When I talk to Democrats, especially Democrats in D.C., they understand sort of, and at least they give me the sense that they feel the urgency, but they also sound defeated. They sound like, what are we actually supposed to do? We don't have enough votes to do all the things that we want to do. Even in their own party, there's a lot of anger being, frankly, directed at Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema. Mm-hmm. And then when you go out into the country, you talk to Democratic voters, like I have in Pennsylvania and other places, they're looking at Democrats and saying, well, why would we give you more power if you haven't figured out how to do this right now?
Because the alternative is worse. I mean, what is the, is that the message?
That's absolutely the message.
Yes, though. I mean, that's not unusual in our democracy that you vote because the other side's worse.
Yeah.
So that we shouldn't act like that's a terrible thing, because that's most presidential elections at the very end, people are saying, well, I'm just voting against the other guy. There are very few where it's like, I'm really for someone. I think Barack Obama was an election where really people were for him. So that doesn't bother me. But I think the thing about Clyburn's interview that stuck with me, that I can't get out of my brain, is him talking about the race war turning violent. And him talking about, you know, we forget 9 people at a Bible study in North Carolina. They were studying the Bible, and someone broke in, and because he said he wanted to start a race war, and murdered them all.
Well, and 10 people in the grocery store.
Somebody, and this kid said, I want to kill black people. I mean, this is something we can't ever let get out of the top of the news, that there are people out there now that are acting on the ugliest stuff in human beings. And it is hate and prejudice and ignorance with a gun, and killing black people because they're black. Well, that's not going to keep happening without there being some kind of consequence that will be unrest. You know, can you blame? I mean, I can't even imagine what it must feel like to live in that community in Buffalo where the grocery store was a place you saw your neighbor. And now
every black grocery store in America feels like Buffalo right now.
Exactly.
I mean, my guess is that this transfers all across the country the minute it happens.
But somehow, and I think what Jim was also talking about, too, is that the top has been taken off of the box that once upon a time, even racists were reluctant to say,
they covered their heads.
Yeah, I'm trying to murder black people because they're replacing us. But even the document, whatever you want to call it, of the shooter in Buffalo, I mean, it's just so bald, so plain, that as though these things that held us back from expressing prejudice or reservation or whatever now doesn't exist anymore. And part of that is Trump letting it all open. And in fact, this, you know, the replacement theory idea does give some kind of incentive, momentum to people to express their racism. And that's what's really, really scary.
Well, I'll give you the last one.
Well, as we talk about this, I think about Martin Luther King and what he said about appalling silence. And it is that you can't just sort of watch this all happen, that it is really the responsibility of Americans all over the country, whether you're impacted or not, to speak up and say, I see this and it is wrong. Because I'm thinking about the fact that one of the first things my mom in particular said to me after the shooting at Mother Emanuel and after the Tops grocery store was, but they're so young. These are young men. Why are they the ones continuously holding this? And it's because we have another generation of Americans who, frankly, are not being educated in the way that they should, who are, frankly, not being told about the history of this country and who are being fed lies. And as a result, we're not just sort of going to grow out of this problem. As I think a large generation of people like Jim Clyburn, like my mother, they thought, OK, well, the next generation will understand this and they'll be a little bit more tolerant. And what we're learning is that's not the way this works.
That's not optimistic at all.
Sorry, I tried.
I mean, let me just ask you one last question. What does your mom say when you explain that, Jerry?
My mom says that that's sad, and that we should try to be safe, and that you should make sure that you're safe. That's what black families in private are telling each other is, okay, well, when you walk into the grocery store, make sure you see the exit. When you're walking into church or you're going to the black circus or going anywhere, which is where I once had a scare when I heard something that made me want to run because I thought, wait, we're at the black circus. We're at the circus that targets African-Americans. If you want to kill people, this is where you would go. So when I'm in spaces like my black church and all these other places, you know that you're in a place where people would target. And that's really sad. But my mother's response is try to keep yourself safe as best you can. And that, I'm sure, is the advice that so many people are unfortunately hearing in Buffalo. And that advice can try to keep you safe, but obviously is not a guarantee.
It's just amazing. It's amazing. The table helps, right? Isn't this better? Mm-hmm. Round table? We have to share you, so we're going to let you go. Thank you so
much
for being here at the table. Nick, Claire, and Rick, stick around. Our conversation continues when we come back. What some, as Claire's already alluded to, are trying to do to save democracy from everything we're talking about. Plus, Rudy's back in the news. He once called it the illegal January 6th Select Committee. Nevertheless, he sat down with that illicit committee for 9 whole hours. What we know about that testimony, one of the most prominent promoters of the ex-president's lies about the election. And later in the program, Election Day tomorrow in Georgia, look at a race that's become the culmination of an effort by some Republicans, as Yamiche has previewed for us, to try and put a stop to Donald Trump's personal vendetta tour, as it's been called. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Ever since December 2020, my family has been under attack. Attacked because people have spread terrible lies about me and my mother, simply because we were doing our jobs, doing the work our democracy requires day in and day out.
Now, democracy prevailed in 2020. But it will only continue to prevail if people of integrity on both sides of the aisle follow the law, uphold our constitutional protections, and ensure that every valid vote is counted.
We face a threat we have never faced before, a former president attempting to unravel our constitutional republic. At this moment, we must all summon the courage to stand against that.
Three remarkable women, three remarkable recipients of this year's John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. They were among 4 Americans honored for their work in defending democracy, despite facing extraordinary pressure, even threats of violence. Claire, you were there. You're part of this committee.
Yeah, it was a great evening. The opening of the evening was a rabbi who had learned the Ukrainian national anthem and sang it. And there was a table of people representing Zelensky there, and you could hear them singing and her singing. And then you had these remarkable people who have just done the simple thing that John F. Kennedy wrote about. They've shown courage when the political consequences were serious and not insignificant. I mean, who knows if Liz Cheney survives,
politically.
Shea or survives. I mean, we've talked about violence in this country. That's what's really heartbreaking about this is the people who show courage, not only do they have to suffer political consequences, but all of these people have been threatened. Their lives have been threatened. Their families have been threatened with violence because they were simply standing up for the voters of this country.
That is so asymmetric, that is so out of whack, that the people protecting the Constitution, protecting our democracy, Republican women there alongside 2 Democratic women, are the ones living in fear of danger. How do you get it back to equilibrium, Rick?
You know, I was thinking about the dinner and even in our last segment talking about this idea of courage. It was Abraham Lincoln, the founder of the Republican Party, who famously said that moral courage is much rarer than physical courage. And The thing that we need to see from Republicans, we were talking about that in the state legislatures, are Republicans that show moral courage. You know what? This isn't right. There was nothing wrong with the election. Everything I've stood for in my entire life tells me that I need to speak out about this, and too few have. And the part of the problem of our system is that the autocracy, as Clyburn talked about, countries elect autocrats, democratically elect autocrats. That's what happened in Hungary. That's what happened in Venezuela. And that's what we could happen to us in 2024. Mm-hmm. We democratically elect an autocrat who then dismantles the Constitution. That's the great danger. That's how democracies die.
Nick, when you're covering these actions in the state, are they attached to these big ideas and conversations about democratic norms and autocratic ones?
I think more often than not, they're rooted a little bit in just pure politics, right? There's a benefit to a lot of Republicans, especially ones who might be facing a primary challenge, to go along with some of the lies about the 2020 election, the efforts to overturn the 2020 election, because they know just how powerful former President Trump is in the Republican Party. You know, his endorsements have won, for the most part, you know, different candidates their races. He's had a few losses, and we still don't know what will happen with Oz in Pennsylvania. But I think it's really kind of rooted in politics. And it's also kind of where you see some of the Republicans kind of caught in the middle, like a Jake Corman in Pennsylvania or Robin Voss in Wisconsin. These are two very conservative Republicans, have a long track record of being conservative Republicans, and we're willing to launch investigations and so-called audits into the election. And we're willing to say falsely that there was widespread fraud or potentially widespread fraud in the 2020 election. But where they still stopped was this effort of either overturning or decertifying the election, saying that we just don't have the constitutional power to do that. So I think a lot of that, you see, they have the political gain that they're willing to go with up to a point. But it can also just be a bit too much for some of these people in leadership positions.
Nick, is there any awareness of, or does anyone ever use Bill Barr or Liz Cheney as backstops for not taking those final steps, lurching toward autocratic practices?
When it comes to state legislatures, I feel like they're slightly, you know, separated from some of those more national political movements. I mean, but at the same time, state legislatures have really become the kind of laboratories of democracy right now. You know, there's not much that gets done in Congress. There's especially with the 50-50 Senate. So you see state legislatures kind of become the labs for a lot of national party platforms. You look at the new abortion law in Texas and in Oklahoma and a lot of these voting laws in Georgia and Texas and Florida. You know, they end up being copied around the country. So I think there is a national conversation when it comes to these state legislatures and what they view, but it's rarely looking to D.C. necessarily for guidance and more kind of at other legislatures and I think just the national party movement.
Well, to you, Nick, for keeping what's going on in these state legislatures on our radar, thank you. And thank you for this incredible reporting that you and your colleagues have today. Thank you for joining us to talk about it. Claire and Rick, stick around. There is a lot that congressional investigators probing the Capitol attack, the insurrection, might want to ask Rudy Giuliani about. They subpoenaed him in January, and 4 months later, lo and behold, he walked through the door. What we know about those 9 hours under oath with Rudy is next.
Over the next 10 days, we get to see the machines that are crooked, the ballots that are fraudulent, and if we're wrong, we will be made fools of. But if we're right, a lot of them will go to jail. So, let's have trial by combat.
Speaking of fools and jail, the January 6th development that broke over the weekend, the Trump attorney who in that video calls for trial by combat, Rudy Giuliani, finally responded to his subpoena, met with House January 6th investigators who are probing his role in the attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. A source telling NBC News that on Friday, Giuliani spoke with the committee for roughly 9 hours, including breaks for we're not sure what. The committee, which subpoenaed Giuliani in January, is investigating his role in publicly promoting, quote, claims that the 2020 election was stolen, as well as participating in attempts to disrupt or delay the certification of the election results based on Giuliani on these allegations. NBC News has reached out to Rudy's attorney for comment. Let's bring into our coverage New York Times congressional reporter Luke Broadwater. Luke, Betsy, I think, described the 1-6 committee's last 2 weeks as a series of breakthroughs. I think you've echoed that sentiment. Talk about what the Rudy interview means for the 1-6 committee.
Well, Rudy was a central player in the plan, whatever word you want to use, to overturn the 2020 election. And so he knows a great deal about all aspects of this plan, probably as much as anybody, with the possible exception of Donald Trump himself and perhaps Mark Meadows. He was instrumental in organizing the fake electors in the various states. He personally had a hand in suggestions to seize voting machines, and he relayed messages on behalf of Donald Trump along those lines. Obviously, he spoke at the Ellipse, and you played the clip where he calls for trial by combat. What does remain to be seen is exactly how much the January 6th committee got out of him. I've spoken with a few people who were there, and his testimony lasted, I think, somewhere, it lasted about 9 hours, but he took an hour and a half break, including he did his radio show from New York live in the air during the break for an hour. And I'm told he invoked executive privilege, attorney-client privilege, rather, quite a bit. That is legitimate. The committee sees that as legitimate. He was Donald Trump's attorney, so there are some things that he can do that for. But they did think they could get information out of him about other aspects, him talking to state legislators or him talking to members of Congress, not necessarily those conversations with Donald Trump, but other aspects of the effort to overturn the election. So I heard at one point it got a little contentious with Representative Raskin of Maryland, but we have not seen a full transcript yet. I haven't gotten personally a really great detailed readout of what all was said during those 7.5 hours or so. But it is a significant development that after however many months it's been since January, that they did finally get him to come in, sit down under oath, and give a sworn deposition.
So, Luke, it seems that probing the fake electors is something that they are, I don't want to use the wrong adjective, but diligently trying to run down. And I think you've reported previously about connective tissue. What was the connective tissue behind the fake electors plot and the White House or the Trump campaign? What is sort of the activity on the campaign level that would suggest that some of that work was done ahead of the Rudy interview?
Well, there's a fair amount. I mean, you have early on, the committee focused on this call that Trump's secretary made to electors in at least Michigan, where she said that they were organizing a push to put forward these false slates of electors and reclaim the election. The committee wrote in some documents that Mike Roman and another gentleman on the Trump campaign possibly organized this effort on behalf of Mr. Giuliani, on behalf of Mr. Trump. So they do see the Trump campaign as directly behind organizing all these different slates of electors in the different states. Now, each state has a different law. Some might allow this, it might be legal, but others it might not be. And that's one thing that I believe the Justice Department is looking at right now, because if people did sign false statements that were sent to the National Archives in violation of their state laws, that they or whoever put them up to it could be in legal jeopardy. So that it is a very serious matter. And, I'm not sure how much Rudy Giuliani told the committee under oath and how often he invoked his privileges with that regard. Mm-hmm. But I do know it was a focus of the committee's questions.
You know, one of the other questions that I've had is, you know, whether or not the committee is trying to stitch together the big gaps in the call logs. And Rudy is really, I mean, I think everybody knows he butt dials reporters. Like, what are his phone records of any interest to the committee? Is that anything you'd want to say?
I would
think his phone records would be of more interest to the committee than whatever babble he produced for hours on Friday. I have a feeling there was nothing that was, there might be around the edges some things they got, they needed. But here's the thing that I think we forget to talk about around the big lie. Has anybody ever seen any evidence of fraud?
No one.
And so,
not even Bill Barr.
And we talk about it, and you always talk about the fact that his director of Homeland Security said it was the most secure election and that Bill Barr said there was no fraud. But what I would like to have is Rudy Giuliani under oath and say, okay, I'm going to sit here as long as you need. Show me. Show me the evidence you have.
18 courts in Pennsylvania went through that exercise. There wasn't any.
They have done the biggest magic act. You know how they make tigers disappear. And these guys have actually gotten the majority of the Republican Party to believe something where there is absolutely no evidence.
That's brilliant. And that's what you want on tape for your televised hearings.
Exactly. I mean, I just wish they would have said, you know, we're here. We'll stay as long as you'd like. Bring it in. Let's see it.
And we don't know that they didn't. Right, Luke?
Yes, but and Rudy's job, I think, was to find the evidence that doesn't exist. I mean,
like
when Donald
Inspector
Trump's
Clouseau.
When Donald Trump's can you find me however many thousand votes? I mean, remember Giuliani went to Ukraine to try to find evidence against Hunter Biden. That was the thing that he was doing. But the thing to remember, I think, is the committee knows a lot. Yeah. They've interviewed 1,000 witnesses.
They do.
They have triangulated. They know everything that Rudy did that day. And they're saying, you know, Mr. Giuliani, at 12:07, when you said X, well, how do you know that? Well, we know that because we have all of this evidence. So I think he, as a former prosecutor, a U.S. attorney, he knows that they're kind of closing in on him, which I hope is the case.
We don't know what he knows to be reality, though, Rick. We have to stipulate that, right?
Okay.
Luke, thank you so much for joining us and for all your great reporting on the investigation. A quick break for us. We will be right back.
Hey, everyone. It's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
We're back with Claire and Rick at the table, which is such a treat. So tell me last night what you heard that inspired you and what made you worried?
Well, it was inspiring to see people who are doing the right thing for the right reasons in government.
Right.
I mean, that's that sentence and all parts of it, you don't get to put together that often anymore.
That's true.
And so that, and for somebody who loves our government and was part of it for many years, it brought a tear to my eye. Especially when Shay Moss was up there recognizing her mother and when Liz Cheney was there saying the words that everybody needs to hear. Perhaps the most haunting moment of the dinner was when a rabbi had who opened the dinner had learned the Ukrainian national anthem.
Right.
And she sang it a cappella. And then you had a table full of diplomats from Ukraine that were singing along with her. And it was almost like an echo in the room because there was no instrumentation at all. And I think everybody in the room felt the weight of what we're doing in Ukraine and why it's so dark. Pardon my language, damn important.
Do you think people make that connection or do you think we have to sort of have that conversation every day about how the survival or demise of their democracy is inextricably linked to ours?
I do think it is. I do think that's a hard conversation. I mean, in light of everything we've been talking about this hour, I think there are lots of Americans who don't get that and might question why are we spending so much money on that? We couldn't even approve a COVID bill in Washington. But again, in terms of the migration towards autocracy, I mean, Russia is the example, is the extreme example of a country that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and had democratic elections and ended up with an autocracy. I mean, that, you know, again, going back to Jim Clyburn, we're not, it can happen here. And that's the big danger.
It's an incredible warning. Thank you both so much for being at the table. Thank you so much. Up next for us, the ex-president's vendetta tour and the GOP's pretty strong effort to try to stop it. All coming to a head tomorrow in Georgia. Preview of it all after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
I hope Mike Pence comes through for us, I have to tell you. I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much.
Famous last words. Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York, 2 days before the deadly insurrection. Donald Trump there was rallying for the Republican candidates in Georgia's runoff Senate elections and pressuring Mike Pence to overturn the results of his 2020 election defeat. Now, almost a year and a half later, that gulf between Trump and Pence is wider than ever, and once again on full display in Georgia, which is holding its primary elections tomorrow. Tonight, Mike Pence will campaign with incumbent Republican Governor Brian Kemp in the GOP race for Georgia governor, a very public break with Donald Trump, who has put all of his weight behind David Perdue, who was running against Kemp in that primary. New York Times writes this, quote, Pence grew close with Kemp during the pandemic and 2020 campaign, and now he is lining up against Trump's handpicked candidate, former Senator David Perdue. But more than that, Pence is seeking to claim a share of credit in what's expected to be the starkest repudiation yet of Trump's attempt to consolidate power, with Kemp widely expected to prevail. The latest poll finds Kemp with a massive lead over Perdue, and that likely victory for Kemp will signal the limit of Trump's influence, as well as the desire for voters to move beyond relitigating the 2020 election. Kemp, who Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss more than any other person, famously defied the president's wishes to overturn the results in Georgia. Perdue, on the other hand, who was picked by the former president to challenge Kemp, has centered his campaign on 2020 election lies and grievances. This race in Georgia, the culmination of an effort by Republican governors to defend against Trump's personal vendetta tour, as one former governor describes it. Reporting in the Washington Post finds this, quote, to protect incumbents up for re-election this year, the Republican Governors Association decided to spend millions of dollars in primaries, an unusual step for an organization that typically reserves its cash for general election matchups against Democrats. The Post goes on to describe the divide within the Republican Party that the former president has fueled. Quote, the clash has brought into focus an extraordinary battle over the future direction of the GOP that extends well beyond Georgia. On one side, an aggrieved former president who retains widespread loyalty in the party from voters. On the other, conservative governors who align with Trump on many issues, but have grown tired of his stolen election claims, which post-election audits have shown to be false. Georgia, as ground zero in determining just how strong Trump's grip on his party is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Washington Post White House reporter Annie Linsky is here. She shares a byline on that reporting we read from at the top. Charlie Sykes is back, editor-at-large of The Bulwark, also an MSNBC contributor. And Charles Blow is here, New York Times columnist and an MSNBC political analyst. I want to start with some of your great reporting, Annie. Let me read a little bit more from it. Republicans backing Kemp have in recent days sought to frame the race as a potentially brutal political setback for Trump. It's clearly the most important race for Trump in the country. He's made Brian Kemp public enemy number one. Chris Christie said, we have to decide if we want to be the party of me or the party of us. And that's what a lot of these primaries are going to decide. Annie, is it saying too much to say that this is sort of the it's not the last stand of Trumpism, but the race in the center ring?
Well, probably not the last stand here for Trumpism, but this is clearly a battle this sort of, for lack of a better word, establishment Republicans have picked Georgia for kind of the biggest showdown to date between Trumpism and just plain old conservatism. And the Republican governors, you know, they got together in November and plotted out a strategy very quietly that would protect a number of their incumbents. But far and away, Georgia is the major, major battle in that. And, you know, the poll that you just showed would suggest that there is a good chance that Kemp can get through tomorrow without going to a runoff and win it outright, which would be an enormous win. And it would create a playbook, right, for conservatives who feel uncomfortable with how far Trump has gone and want to stand up to him in some areas. Not all. I mean, this isn't a total repudiation of everything Trump stands for, but it does draw a line at election integrity.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Charlie Sykes, the bad news, worst news here is that Kemp is the person who signed into law a voter suppression bill that was so offensive to Major League Baseball that they moved the All-Star game out of the state of Georgia. Now, a massive boycott did not ensue, but that law, I pressed Raffensperger on it. There was no fraud. They audited the vote three times. There was no fraud. There was nothing to fix with their voter integrity legislation. So it's a real settling in terms of bad versus worse. What do you make of the Pence-Trump dynamic?
Well, I mean, Mike Pence has been tiptoeing away from Donald Trump, but this is an open break. Look, I mean, this is not the end of Trumpism. This party is still controlled by Donald Trump. But this is not nothing. This is significant. You know, when you have Mike Pence going down to Georgia, when you have Chris Christie, when you have Doug Ducey of Arizona, when you have these other, you know, major figures who are clearly defying Donald Trump. And I have to tell you, in Mar-a-Lago, he has to see this as a very, very serious challenge. And what the Republican Governors Association has done is also significant, because it has already led to the defeat of Trump's endorsed candidates for governor in Nebraska and in Idaho. Now, of course, you have an election denier who won in Pennsylvania. But this race in Georgia does feel as if it is a marker. And now I think it would be a mistake to say, you know, this is an indication that, you know, that Trump is doomed in the Republican Party, because that's not true. But if there was ever going to be a Republican jailbreak from Donald Trump, it would start with something like this, where you have the party rallying around a very conservative Republican governor who is in no way a rhino, but has been targeted specifically and really solely because of his refusal to go along with the big lie. So this is a pure referendum on Donald Trump's most important obsession, and he's going to lose badly in a crucial state tomorrow.
You know, Charles, I'm curious your thoughts about the race, but it strikes me that Kemp and Raffensperger, who's in a much tighter race against an election denier who says he would have overturned the results in that state's free and fair election, we should be covering them as witnesses in an investigation to plot a coup against the United States government. I wonder your views about the attention on this race and the dynamic between Trump and Pence.
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to take a slightly different position from my other two panelists here, which is to say there may be a slight repudiation of Trump, the person, but there is absolutely no repudiation whatsoever of Trumpism right here in Georgia. I'm here in Georgia now. I've been living here for the last 2 years. The pretext for that bill that you mentioned, Nicole, was that there was something faulty about the 2020 election and that it had to be fixed, and that those bills have gone a long way. We focus a lot on the making it illegal to bring people water in line because it's so obscene that you would do that in Georgia, where it gets hot all the time. But there are bigger issues in that bill. It moves calling an election away from the sole purview of the Secretary of State to the state legislature. We have no idea how that is going to work out, particularly if we get a close election, whether that be on the state level or on the presidential level. They also made it easier to overtake the election board in Fulton County. Fulton County, for anybody who doesn't understand it, that is where Atlanta is. That is a very Black part of the state, very diverse part of the state. It is the capital of the state. They have embraced Trumpism full bore. And if you watch the gubernatorial debate, which I watched, multiple candidates on that stage said that the 2020 election was stolen, and there was no pushback from a single candidate other than Kemp. And he was mild about it. He kept saying, you know, I don't like what happened. I don't like the result, but I have to do what I had to do. There is no pushback against Trumpism here in Georgia. They're just being self-interested in not wanting to lose, and so they are choosing Kemp.
So, Annie, that's interesting. Does it manifest itself in different, like, will Pence's message for Kemp be different on a substantive level than Trump's message for Perdue?
Well, it certainly seems that way if you think about what they've been saying so far. And, you know, as you note, tonight is this very interesting evening where, you know, Pence is coming in, you know, on one side for Perdue, one side for Kemp, but Trump is also coming in that sort of a last minute town hall rally to gather forces behind Perdue. So you have these two, you know, former governing partners doing dueling rallies in the same state against one another. And, you know, all along, Kemp has been very careful to say, look, I'm not picking a fight with Trump here. As he said today, I know Trump seems like he's angry at me. I'm not angry at him. You know, we just disagreed with how to handle the 2020 election, and I did what I thought was right. So Kemp is trying not to be, you know, seen as picking a fight with Trump. Whereas on the other side, you know, Perdue, we would imagine this is a preview of what Trump will say, you know, this evening, it has been very eager to bring up the 2020 election, to claim that Kemp was dividing the state in some way, as he did at a rally today. So I think on one side, there's been sort of a desire to kind of move past the 2020 election and talk about other issues. There are plenty of conservative issues that are on, you know, being discussed: tax cuts, abortion restrictions, that type of, you know, as you point out, a new election bill that Kemp has been wanting to focus on, whereas Perdue has just gone back time and time again to 2020. And so this is almost like the playbook. Like, can you move on from 2020? And I think that these forces, these Republican governors, Pence, are trying to say this is a pathway for us as a party to move beyond these claims and look forward rather than back to the 2020 election.
You know, and Charlie, the vantage point, if you're interested, I guess, in small d democracy, is that in a primary, you want the least autocratic candidates to face off against the other party, right? So I guess in that context, it is better that the candidate less hostage to the lie looks like he's going to win running away. But we've talked a lot about what Trump does when he's humiliated and defeated. It looks like he'll be both this week. What do you think his, you know, response is?
Well, that's what's going to be interesting about this tele-rally tonight. He hasn't been in Georgia since, I think, late March. So he wants to distance himself from the defeat because Donald Trump never likes to be around losers. But look, you know, let me just disagree with the argument that this is not a repudiation of a big part of Trumpism. Yes, the Republican Party. Yes, Brian Kemp is very Trumpy. But the heart right now of Trumpism is the big lie. And let's focus on that. What is the great threat to our constitutional order? It is the lie and everything that flows out of it. And that's what's being litigated right now in Georgia. And so I agree very much with the analysis that says that, look, This is the roadmap for a Republican Party that says, look, we can continue to be Republicans. We are conservative Republicans. By the way, people should not expect a post-Trump Republican Party to be progressive or liberal. It's going to be conservative. But this is the roadmap, and there is a way. And that's why you have governors like Larry Hogan and others around the country who are saying, look, we need as a party to move past the big lie. And moving past the big lie is inseparable from moving past Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is never going to give up this big lie. He is never going to move past insisting now that this is the litmus test. So I do think this is significant, and I do think that it's worth paying a lot of attention to, because it is going to be a setback for Donald Trump. And, you know, you have devoted a lot of time to the insurrection and the constant ongoing coup attempts and the ongoing January 2nd. Well, that's all tied up with Donald Trump insisting that the election in Georgia was stolen. And tomorrow night, the governor, who didn't like the outcome, but is saying that the election was not stolen, is going to defeat Donald Trump's handpicked candidate. So that's kind of a BFD.
I agree with your slicing the right of our country off, that seeing if you can break its fever of this autocratic, it's not an attraction, it's an obsession. And I wonder, Charles, if you want to respond to that. And if you think, if you know, obviously we still live in a two-party system, Republican primary is going to be waged between someone who is more and less Trumpy. Is it better for democracy if the less Trumpy one wins?
Well, first I'll say this. Kemp is talking out of both sides of his mouth. I just still disagree with Mr. Sykes, because what Kemp is basically saying is, I believe that the election was correctly called, and yet I signed into legislation bill number one that completely goes against that. That bill number one basically says there was something wrong with the election and we have to fix it, right? And then they've gone back to take a second bite of the apple with the same pretext. There was something wrong and we have to fix it. But he gives the lip service to the fact to the idea of saying, I believe that it was okay. Well, if it's okay, you didn't need the voter suppression laws, which you stood on that debate stage and promoted as if they were something to be applauded for. He can't have it both ways. And so I just believe that his stance of like, oh, I believe it was fine, is pretty much a lie, because he went back on it by signing that bill. Second thing is, what I think we should look for is for Trump to do exactly what he did in 2020 in the senators' races, which made a lot of Republicans stay home. Basically, Trump rained on the parade and basically said, because these people are running who I don't like, and that election was bad, then you shouldn't vote, basically, is what he was saying. And they didn't. And I think that if Kemp wins, we could expect Trump to do the very same thing, which is to say, I don't like the guy, you should just punish him by staying home. And you could get enough of that, of the same effect of 2020, that you could get Kemp to lose.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie, DeSantis has done the same thing. Yeah. DeSantis, in the days after the election, said, look at my state. It's a model of integrity in terms of voter security. And then, as Charles is saying, he went ahead and passed a voter suppression law masquerading as I don't even want to say it. What are your thoughts about the Raffensperger race? Raffensperger is running against another election denier, and that race is much closer.
Well, and that race arguably is more important because, the Secretary of State played a crucial role in 2020. And of course, his power has been changed under this law. But that's also going to be one of the real tells about whether or not people are willing to go along with this. But I should also point out that Brad Raffensperger, who is a man of great integrity and great political courage, who really has put his career on the line, also supported that legislation. Look, I think it was a bad bill, but I do think that, some of the claims about it have been exaggerated. For example, if it was an attempted voter suppression, and I think some of the supporters were hoping for it, the vote has not been suppressed. The early vote in Georgia is higher than it's ever been before. And Brad Raffensperger makes a strong case that many of the changes were technical changes. So I do think a distinction needs to be made between the legislation, which I think was a bad bill, but that legislation, and the big lie. The big lie is something particular. That is the real threat. That is Donald Trump calling up Brad Raffensperger and says, I need you to find 11,000 votes. This is the president of the United States planning a coup. The other details about the election, we can argue about some other time, but they are not in the same universe of this. So when we talk about this, if we think that democracy faces an existential challenge, well, let's act like it. Let's actually treat this issue. And the existential challenge is Donald Trump trying to install officials around the country who will literally steal the election. And that is really what's on the ballot tomorrow. So you can disagree with the bill that Brad Raffensperger also supported, but don't let that erase the fact that he was one of the crucial men of integrity that prevented the steal the first time around and may the next time around.
And we heard it all on tape. Ominous sound of a sitting American president asking another official to find him, 11,780 votes. Annie Linsky, thank you for spending some time with us with your reporting. Charlie Sykes, thank you for starting us off. Charles Blow sticks around for the hour. Tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern, my friend and colleague Joy Reid will report her show live from Georgia ahead of tomorrow's primary elections. She will be joined by Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. That's coming up what? 2 hours from now, 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on MSNBC. Up next for us, 2 years after the murder of George Floyd and 1 week after a massacre in Buffalo that left 10 people dead, the vast majority of African Americans say they live with fear, the fear that they or someone they love will become a victim in a violent, racially motivated attack. The Reverend Al Sharpton, just back from Buffalo, will join our conversation after a quick break. Later in the hour, a Russian diplomat calls out his country and its leadership over the war in Ukraine. We'll get a live report from our friend Cal Perry in Kyiv. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Stay with us.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
All right, take a deep breath. Wednesday is going to mark 2 years since the murder of George Floyd. Now, anyone who lived through the days and weeks that ensued, and for those of us who covered it, it's safe to say we believe we were living through a long, long overdue racial reckoning in this country. But some important new reporting in the Washington Post holds a mirror to our country, and it is not pretty. Brand new polling from the Washington Post and Ipsos reports this, quote, 3/4 of Black Americans are worried that they or someone they love will be attacked because of their race. The Post continues with this, quote, in June 2020, at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests, 1 month after Floyd's death, 54% of Black Americans expected police treatment of Black Americans would improve in the coming years, according to a poll taken then. But today, less than half as many, 19%, say it actually did. Another 38% say police treatment has improved a little, while 41% say it has not improved at all. Joining me on set, the Reverend Al Sharpton, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. Pete Strzok here, former FBI counterintelligence agent. Charles Blow is still with us as well. This story stopped me in my tracks. And, you know, we have had so many conversations and we've been on the air together hours and hours after George Floyd's murder. And this crushing feeling that nothing has changed and maybe it's gotten worse seems to be the prevailing view.
It is the prevailing view. And I can tell you, as I move around the country with National Action Network chapters and on my radio show, that I'm hearing it every day. But also, you must remember, Nicole, I've probably done 6 funerals.
I know you have.
Of police-related killings since George Floyd, including 10 miles from where we had the trial that convicted his killer with Dante Wright. So there must be legislative change. I think the things that is missing, and this is what we've said to the White House, is that when you had a moment like Selma, you had Lyndon Johnson step forward and the Senate and the Congress passed a voting rights bill. When we had other moments right after Dr. King's assassination, open housing, a civil rights bill after we saw what happened with the 4 girls in Birmingham. The tragedy of George Floyd that awakened a movement all over the world, and we were rallying everywhere. We had 200,000 people at our rally at Lincoln Memorial in August during a pandemic. You never would have believed we could have done that. No legislation. When we get the George Floyd bill up, a Black Republican, Tim Scott, backed out on qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. No legislation. That's why we've been pushing the president to at least do an executive order on some policing facts. And of course, he can't do all that would have been in that legislation, but we want to do something. So why would people think things change when nothing's on the ground changing? Police are still shooting people. And there's not even something to say enforce the new law or enforce the new mm-hmm. rules because they're not there.
But Rev, it seems to exist around a separate axis, and that is the rise of domestic violent extremism, which, as Trump's FBI director testified to, is the biggest chunk of that is white supremacy.
The biggest threat in this country is white supremacy. I think Homeland Security Secretary said that. And they're doing it openly. What is frightening to me, and I was in Buffalo for 2 days last week, I'm going back to do two eulogies at two of the last funerals. What frightens me is in my mother and grandmother's time, the Ku Klux Klan at least put hoods on. They didn't want you to know who they were. This guy live streamed who he was. Like, look at me. I'm going to show you me killing blacks. And I want to pick up followers. If we're in an era where people are not even ashamed or hiding, but think they can just do it openly and live stream it, and we have these platforms that are not regulated, if you or I said something right now that was over the line, we're regulated. They get on social media and have 180-page manifestos talking about Jews are using blacks to replace whites. It is absolutely frightening to everybody. And I think that people look at this like this is just another news story, unless you live in a certain silo where you are the target of this.
Charles Blow, we talked about this story in this poll in the last hour, and Yamiche Alcindor said that, you know, the conversation she has with her mom is about staying safe at the grocery store, staying safe at your church. I want your thoughts about the poll, and I want your thoughts about what the most constructive conversation is to have day in and day out.
Well, I think that we are caught in a horrible, horrible cycle that Black people simply feel like we cannot find our way out of. Black people, like any other person on the planet, just want to be safe. They want to be safe from community violence. They want to be safe from state violence. They want to be safe from things that are not physical violence. They want to be safe from political violence, people taking away their voice because they can't vote. They want to be safe from cultural violence, with people erasing their history and saying, you cannot talk about what has happened to you. But what America keeps saying to Black people is you cannot have it all. If you have safety from police violence, then community violence will go up on you because police won't be able to do their jobs. The only way the police can do their jobs is you have to be collateral damage in them doing their job. That if they hurt someone, if they kill someone, then that is just part of the job of keeping you safe from your own community. And so I think that that becomes the cycle, and that is where the despair is born, which is that you, America keeps saying to Black people, there is nothing that we can do. If it's like a seesaw, if we do this one thing, then the other thing will rise. If this goes down, that rises. That cannot be the answer. And yet we are locked in a position where our politicians will not respond to us. I believe that Reverend Al is right on track when he says they should be pushing the White House to offer an executive order. The White House was actually going to do that. But then it leaked, and then the police unions got a look at it. They freaked out. The White House started calling around to say, don't freak out, don't freak out, don't freak out. And then we have not heard about that executive order since. No one seems to have the political courage to come to the defense of Black people and say, you are right. You deserve to feel safe.
Charles, if something like that happens, what is sort of the parallel experience piece that has to accompany a change in policy at this point?
You know, this is very difficult because, you know, so much of what concerns police violence is on the state level. There are no national police, right? So that is part of the problem with federal police guidelines. They were going to be able to go some of the way, but not all of the way, because the federal government cannot supervise. The Department of Justice can supervise if they step in, investigate, and determine that there needs to be a consent decree, then they can supervise. But on an individual level, with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of individual police departments, you can't do that. So you have to have some level of control on the state level. And there you see Republicans basically stepping in to say, we're going to even suppress the vote here so that you have less representation. We're going to draw the maps differently so that you have less representation in your state legislature as well as in Congress. So it's, you're asking me to answer a question that I find very difficult because the system itself is making it incredibly difficult. And so people are doing what they can do. They're passing local ordinances that help. Maybe it's wearing a body cameras. There are some states that have stepped in and said, we will take the lead on some police reforms. Nationally, though, it's very difficult to see how we make those steps forward.
And Pete Strzok, on the other sort of prong of this, which is, you know, not just any Republican president, but Donald Trump's handpicked FBI director, Christopher Wray, testified in the late summer of 2020 that the greatest threat to the homeland was domestic violent terrorism of the white supremacy variety. If anyone's FBI director had testified to the greatest threat to the homeland being any other sort of ideology, the Patriot Act would have passed 98-0 or 99-0, which is what I think it passed in 2001. Why is there so much paralysis? Is it as obvious as it looks that one of the two parties views some of these people as part of their coalition? Why no action on protecting the homeland from domestic violent extremism?
Well, Nicole, I think there are a number of reasons that go into that. I mean, one of it is that I think any discussion of racial bias is inherently difficult, certainly coming from the majority side. It is one of the few good things that came out in the summer of 2020 was a willingness of across the board of police departments and others to at least sit down and start talking about whether or not reforms were needed and what they might look like. But I think that what adds on to that already difficult conversation to have in the best case is, in fact, a large number of the Republican Party who are embracing things like critical replacement theory. And when you look, you know, for instance, Elise Stefanik information has come out where she has been, you know, parroting and putting forth replacement theory as part of her ads. And not only that, but she has corporate sponsors who continue to donate to her campaign. So it's already a difficult conversation when you add in one entire political party who not only are sort of tacit allowing the sort of racist or biased potential views to exist, but openly embracing them. When people are, you know, these horrible beliefs that people, you know, white supremacists and others are embracing, if they see national leaders not just being silent, but actually actively embracing and tacitly encouraging that sort of behavior, that's what really allows these sorts of beliefs to take hold, not just among one or two, but to spread very, very broadly. And I'm really discouraged when you look at the national picture, mm-hmm. where we're going in terms of the willingness to accept or not accept this sort of unacceptable behavior.
Well, that's what you're saying, Rob, that they used to cover their faces. They don't anymore, and they're out in light of day.
They don't cover their faces, and those political segregationists and racists at the time were marginalized. You did not see Lyndon Johnson or John Kennedy with Lester Maddox or George Wallace. These people are sitting up in senior positions in the Senate and the Congress, like Stefanik, that are talking about replacement theories. Replacing who? Most people, unless you were from Great Britain protesting King George, came here. We were already here since 1619. Who are we replacing? If anything, we helped build a country that they were appealed to come to. So at the same time, you're saying don't have critical race theory in the schools, which happen to not be in the schools, but we're going to talk about people replacing us. The Native Americans and the blacks were already here when we got here. In fact, we came here because they built the country, made it seem like it could be enriching, and never got paid for it. And on top of all these insults, grandma can't go to the supermarket?
Sick. It's sick. It's a sickness. We need all of you to stick around. We're going to sneak in a quick break. We'll be right back.
And we all believed that we were going to get, finally, some federal reform on the national level in policing, and it languished and stalled in the United States Senate. President Biden hopefully is going to do something, to whether it's an executive order, something to usher some federal decree that we have to address policing in America. Because if he doesn't, where do we get hope when we go out and vote in the polls, but yet we see nothing happen?
Nothing less than hope on the line. That was civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, who represented George Floyd's family, on what he hopes comes next from the Biden administration. Rev, what would that do? I mean, what can an executive order do short of legislation?
Well, according to what it is, but in it, it could set some federal standards, sets guidelines that things you can and cannot do. But it also will set a tone.
Right.
It is absolutely correct. Policing is done on a state level. But if you have a federal executive order, you then have an argument to go to these states, organize around this is what an executive order is federally, and this is what we want to organize and challenge our state legislatures on. But there's no model here, and there's nothing to work from. And I think it is important that you set a tone in this country that is these things are intolerable. We're talking about people getting shot in the back of their head by police, a man's knee on a neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. I mean, it is absolutely unthinkable that we have not seen any legislative or concrete executive action. And I think that, again, I blame Tim Scott, who's black. I blame Manchin and Sinema, because we were that close to getting the George Floyd bill through and they didn't do it, which is why it's all the more reason why the president has to set a tone that his Senate Democrats would not do because of two candidates and one Republican on the other side. If we had had the filibuster changed, we could have brought the George Floyd bill through. It didn't even get to the Senate because Tim Scott said, no, we will not deal with qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. So 2 years later, after I went to marches, Nicole, where there were more whites than blacks.
Well, this is what I want to deal with. And I want to take this on from Charles' last answer. The despair is rooted in all of it, right? That there is no progress. And you saw public opinion swing from, I think, 55% of all Americans associated themselves with the aims of Black Lives Matter. It swung up to 76% of all Americans who supported the goals of Black Lives Matter. A movement can't be asked to do more than that, swing public opinion 25 points.
And a movement that was basically very peaceful. You had one or two situations, but it was
that
all
were condemned by politicians in both parties
immediately, and by those of us leading him. So what are we supposed to do? Just sit there and allow ourselves to continue to be targets? And this is the moment the George Floyd movement had brought us to, and we missed that moment. We've got to now deal with it, though, because Buffalo reminds us how life for blacks in America is certainly not regarded and respected. When a man can say, one of the reasons that this 18-year-old chose Top Supermarket, I was just there. It's the only grocery store supermarket in that neighborhood.
It was a food desert.
How do you, in a food desert, he knew if I go there on a Saturday afternoon, a lot of blacks are going to be shopping. Now, what people don't realize, how do you, in a city that you just ratified or confirmed millions of dollars, somewhere around $100 million to build a new football stadium, but you can't build grocery stores and economic development in the black community? I mean, this is the climate that we live in. And on top of that, we have to fear for our lives.
Charles, Ben Crump there also talked about needing this hope before they're asked to go back to the polls. What are your thoughts about the political considerations of inaction?
Yeah, it's really dire, quite frankly. Rev made a great point about that executive order would set a tone, but it is a problem for the administration now because they've already set a tone, right? So the president stood up in the State of the Union address and said that we don't need to defund the police. We need to fund the police even more. We need more policing. One of the things that an executive order can do, it can allow people, agents, basically it would be directed agencies. So agencies can collect more data on things. They can study things. That's what an executive order could do. It can't make criminal law. So it won't be able to do that, but it can direct agencies to give more money to states or to withhold money from states, depending on how they behave on certain metrics. Well, if you've already said in the State of the Union address that you believe that the answer here is to give more money to local policing, it's very hard to change that tone. That is what is now on the record. That is one of the biggest speeches that any president is ever going to give, is the State of the Union address. So it really becomes a difficult situation. And I think there are a lot of people, particularly, I think everybody should be worried about young people. Those are largely the people who were in the streets. They were looking for some sort of change. And on this thing that all of them spent all of that time and energy and effort in the streets protesting, it looks like almost nothing on the federal level will come from it. Everyone should be worried about that, scared of that, and how that ripples through to Election Day.
Yeah, and you talk about people feeling separated and disconnected from our politics. It's a perfect illustration of a movement gaining so much steam, changing the dynamics, and to all of your points. Nothing.
We told them to vote that they could get change with voting. Now what are we supposed to tell them?
No, it's,
and I think that's got to be answered.
All right, we'll stay on it. Thank you all so much. The Reverend Al Sharpton, Charles Blow, Pete Strzok, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. Switching gears, a stinging indictment and a bold resignation from a Russian diplomat who says he has never been more embarrassed for his country 3 months into Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. The latest from Kyiv, and our friend Cal Perry is after a quick break. Stay with us.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
We're following several big stories out of the war in Ukraine, starting with the diplomatic shakeup at the UN. A veteran diplomat in Russia's mission to the UN quit his post in Geneva earlier today, expressing shame over his country's actions during the war. Boris Bondarev, who spent 20 years in Russia's foreign ministry, becomes the highest profile diplomat to protest Russia's war. In an email announcing his resignation this morning, he says this, quote, "The aggressive war unleashed by Putin against Ukraine and, in fact, against the entire Western world is not only a crime against the Ukrainian people, but also, perhaps, the most serious crime against the people of Russia." The resignation comes after another weekend of attacks from Russia as it continued to pound the country's east and southern regions with airstrikes and artillery. Let's bring in, you can guess it, NBC News correspondent Cal Perry live for us in Kyiv. So, Cal, let's start with the war and the reality on the ground. I was reminded today that it has not diminished. We just perhaps aren't spending quite as much time and attention focused on it.
Yeah, and I think we had a reality check today from President Zelensky. He spoke today to Davos and the business meetings that are happening there. And in the backdrop of food insecurity around the world created by this war, we learned of a number of attacks in the last week that are more serious than maybe we thought. Last Tuesday in the town of Desna, there was an airstrike in which at least 87 people, he said, were killed. We think the death toll could be far higher because we wonder if it's not a military target. I say that because we cannot film there. So we assume it probably is a military target. And again, the death toll could be far higher. In this speech, he also said that up to 50 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers could be dying every day in the eastern part of the country. We don't have a realistic idea of the death toll when it comes to Ukrainian soldiers. But based on what we're hearing today from the president, it could be in the thousands. The backdrop to that is the city of Mariupol, not far from the video that you're looking at here. And officials there say the death toll could be in the tens of thousands. This is me answering your question. When you sort of lay it out as this war is marching on, and this war is marching on in a way that is difficult to cover every day because it is so spread out, because it is so widespread, not only in scale, but in the attacks that Russia is carrying out. Now, Ukraine and Ukrainian forces are counterattacking in Kharkiv, but just tonight, as I was coming to this live location, the center of Kharkiv has come under heavy artillery bombardment. So those initial gains that the Ukrainian military made that were very dramatic in pushing Russian forces back from the capital have slowed. And this timetable that I think we applied to Vladimir Putin may not have been realistic because the slow slog sort of continues, Nicole.
And it serves Russia better than Ukraine, where their civilian population isn't being targeted. Their economy is being decimated by sanctions, but not war and a lack of basic services. I wonder if you can speak to, you know, does the resignation of a decades-long civil servant in Russia's foreign ministry, is it a big deal? Is it exploited by the Ukrainians? Is it diminished by the Russians? I mean, tell me what happens in both countries when there is a protest resignation.
It seems like in Russia, it's ignored. It feels like the information in Russia just kind of disappears into this black hole. And that's one of the reasons you have, for example, the Ukrainian president and Ukrainian military using Telegram as a channel. Here, I think the battlefield gains are flagged more than the diplomatic gains. So the dead Russian generals is something that people talk here more about, that they are inflicting real pain on the Russian military. There are rumors, I should say, that run rampant here about Vladimir Putin and his health and whether or not he's making meetings, and those videos of him with that long table are played on repeat here and are sort of diagnosed and diagrammed and questioned because people here wonder about his leadership and how long he will last. But all of that is kind of typical of a war zone, and it's kind of typical, I think, of two countries at war to wonder whether or not these things are happening. I think the diplomatic news out of New York is not going to land here very big. Again, and compared to the battlefield gains, it's not something people pay attention to.
What is the degree, just relatively speaking, of people's sense of security in Kyiv, which is trying to, I don't know if snap back is the right word, but return to a new normal?
It's totally bizarre. So I spent part of the weekend on an electric scooter going around town, getting coffee and talking to people. And you go through checkpoints. You go through anti-tank checkpoints. You go past buildings that are completely destroyed. But it's a city where people are coming back here. It's a city where children are finally returning. I think I said to you a couple weeks ago there were no kids here. There are kids here now. The other thing that's happened in Kyiv, which is really weird, is they've dragged the tanks, the old burned out, not old, the burned out tanks from the Russian invasion, and they put them in the square behind me, and they put them outside the library. And so as people return to their homes and as people collect their families and their belongings, they're coming back to the city and they're able to walk by the burned out remnants of this war, because I can go to Irpin about 30 minutes here. I can go to Borodyanka about 45 minutes from here. But you can't travel. If you're Ukrainian, you can't travel through these checkpoints. Travel is restricted to the area you're from. So the government is bringing in, again, the sort of detritus of this war into the city center so that the people who are returning home can see it.
What is sort of the pace of soldiers from the front line being able to come back and see families and sort of refreshing the horrors of the front line and seeing their families? And what is sort of the strain on military families look like right now?
So I think there's a difference between those who are on the front, fighting on the front. We see them rotate back to visit their families, but it's not something that is talked about, I think, for operational security reasons.
Yeah.
You have the Civil Defense Force, which is sort of the widely conscripted force that sets up checkpoints and helps deal with civil defenses. Those folks are here. You see those folks grabbing coffee. You see them at dinner. You see them out and about. So you really have a separation, I think. There is little that I think we know really about what is happening on the front line, what is happening with those frontline Ukrainian Marines, special forces, the ones that are fighting every day in combat with the Russians. It's why I think the country was a little bit jarred to hear today the president say 50 to 100 of them could be dying every day, because it's something we just don't really have access to.
No, it's an incredible insight that even there are parts of this that remain opaque. Cal Perry, a treasure, live for us in Kyiv. Thank you so much. Please stay safe, my friend.
Thanks.
A quick break for us. We'll be right back. All right, so it took me 1 hour and 59 minutes, but we do have some good news to tell you about, a story we covered at length last week. John Fetterman, Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor and the Democratic nominee in that state's U.S. Senate race, is out of the hospital and resting at home with his family following a stroke. His wife, Giselle, who did her best for the campaign during her husband's week-plus recovery, shared this video of that big moment. Fetterman says he's focused on getting back to 100%. So he'll be ready to flip that seat in November. Who he'll face is still an open question, but for now, a little R&R for him is the most important thing. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes on this Monday. We are grateful.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.